There's this story that's told about Pablo Picasso. Might be true, I don't know. It goes like this. Picasso's sitting at a cafe in Paris. A woman recognizes him. She comes up and asks him to draw her picture. He does. Takes about 3 minutes. She asks how much she owes him. He gives an amount she thinks is exorbitant. So she sputters, "But that sketch only took you 3 minutes." Picasso replies, "No, madame. It took me my whole life." Many creative projects are like that. You develop a skill over time, you have an idea that you turn over in your head and explore some more, and you hone. And if we're all lucky, it's eventually shared. Well, such is the case with the newly published books written by two old friends of mine. We were all foreign correspondents together in China in the late 90s, when Ian Johnson was there first with the Baltimore Sun and then with the Wall Street Journal. Jennifer Lin was China correspondent for Knight Ridder, and I was with NPR. And even back then, Jennifer would sometimes talk about wanting to write a book about her Chinese family, her dad's side, and the interesting, complicated, sometimes tragic tale of what happened as different generations embraced Christianity over more than a century of rapid change. Her new book, Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family, tells that story. And Ian? Well, he won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his coverage in China of Falun Gong. That's a spiritual sect that spooked the Communist Party so much that it outlawed the group and imprisoned tens of thousands of its followers. China does, after all, have a history of religious groups becoming political threats to the existing power. Ian's book, Wild Grass, includes a story on a Falun Gong follower. He went on to report in Berlin for a few years, and post-9/11 he wrote another book. It was called A Mosque in Munich, about how radical Islamists had established an early beachhead in Germany. And then he returned to China, eventually writing for the New York Times and the New York Review of Books, and becoming, in my opinion, one of the most insightful Western interpreters of Chinese culture and cultural change writing at the moment. His new book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, explores why a growing number of Chinese people are embracing religion in an era of rising prosperity. For those who thought, as many used to, that prosperity and development would usher in a new era of secular modernism, well, this century is full of surprises. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And in any century, how we answer the big questions of life, where we find meaning and how we act on it, are at the core of who we are as individuals and who we are as a society. China is, of course, the birthplace of two of the world's great philosophic traditions, Confucianism and Taoism. Buddhism was born in India, but then it traveled to China and was absorbed and synthesized with aspects of Taoism, Confucianism, and folk religion into a belief system that is uniquely China's. The search for meaning in China has continued over the centuries, and it intensified over the past 150 years or so as China had more contact with the West and realized it had some modernizing and reimagining of itself to do. By the late 19th century and continuing into the 20th, Chinese were puzzling over how they could embrace some Western ideas while holding on to the essence of Chinese culture. But what was the essence of Chinese culture, and which Western ideas were worth embracing? Most could agree that science and scientific advances were worthwhile, as were new approaches to education. Some embraced Christianity. And by the 1920s, a growing number of mostly young Chinese were embracing another set of ideas that came from the West: Marxism, Leninism, Communism. Embedded within these ideas was the idea that religion was the opiate of the masses, even though many of the rituals of the Soviet and the Chinese Communist parties demanded a kind of reverence and a leap of faith usually found in religions. Under Mao Zedong in China, believers of any faith other than communism were at first tolerated, to a degree, then persecuted, and then, after Mao, after tens of millions of premature deaths and an avoidable famine, after a decade of turmoil and destruction of lives and cultural relics during the Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 76, The search for meaning in China began anew. And so, to talk about all of this, Jennifer, Ian, and I sat down in a recent conversation before a live audience at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco. If you don't know the place, it's a grand old institution in San Francisco, more than a century old, with the mechanics part referring to anyone who makes something, including writers and artists. It's in a beautiful old building with a great library and a chess room. We pulled this event together along with the Overseas Press Club West, a group of dozens of former foreign correspondents in the Bay Area. So I'm including some questions from the audience at the end, because they're good questions with interesting answers. I started off by asking Jennifer to take us back to the moment in the mid-19th century in a little fishing village on China's southern coast when her great-great-grandfather encountered his first Western missionary.
My family's from southern China, Fujian. And the Anglican missionaries arrived there around 1860 or so. And actually, they had a really hard time converting anyone. And part of it, much of it, was the legacy of the Opium War. The missionaries were lumped in with the traders. Chinese did not see them as any different from the opium traders. They were foreigners. And for 10 years, they still hadn't converted anyone. And this one Anglican was writing back to the Home Office in London saying, "I preach and I preach and I preach and nothing happens." And so the Hong Kong bishop was actually going to close the mission. But then there arrived a missionary. His name was John Wolfe. He was the son of poor Irish farmers. And John Wolfe said, "You're doing it all wrong. Forget about the city of Fuzhou and the literati. Go to the villages, the fishing villages, go to the farms." And so they did, and then they had luck. So my great-great-grandfather was among that group of people. He was an illiterate farmer, fisherman from the town of Ardu. I come from a long line of oystermen, apparently. He embraced the religion. And he went to work in Fuzhou for the Anglican missionaries as a cook. You know, it was an employee-employer relationship at the very beginning. So the question is, why would anyone convert to Christianity in the first place? And I think if you're a peasant living in rural China in the 1800s, your life is pretty difficult. The missionaries show up and they say, "Listen, read this book, follow these Ten Commandments, and you'll find happiness." That resonated. So the Anglicans, once they went out into the field, they had much more success in spreading their ideas.
Well, so was it, "Oh, I can find happiness this way," or was it also, "Hey, these missionaries, they might help me live a better life materially as well"?
Both. So my great-great-grandfather went to work for them as a cook. And that class of Christians, they were often derided as rice Christians. Because, yes, there were benefits. And the missionaries often get a bad rap in the history books. But in addition to bringing their ideas, they did open schools. They educated girls. They opened hospitals. They brought Western medicine to the Chinese. So the cook's son was trained by the missionaries to be a doctor. And he went to work in a mission hospital in Funing, which is now called Shapu. It's in Fujian. And he worked there with a missionary doctor in a hospital where two-thirds of the patients were opium addicts. So, yes, there was a climbing up the societal ladder if you affiliated yourselves with the missionaries.
Yeah. So, Ian, in the half century before the Communist Party came to power, there was incredible social change in China. There was the end of the imperial era. There were all these new schools opening up, new Western influences. There was a vibrant film industry in Shanghai, you know, some really interesting journalism going on. Put in context, if you would, what else was going on with religion and belief and the search for meaning in China at that time?
Yeah, I think a couple of things that also relates to what Jennifer was saying. There was this incredible self-doubt, so that you had this feeling that the entire system that ran China, including the religious system, was a problem. And so a lot of temples, there were roughly a million temples in China at the end of the 19th century, and by the middle of the 20th century, half of these temples had been destroyed or converted to other use. So even as early as the late 19th century, reformers were saying we have to close down temples and open schools because we need to, you know, get rid of all this old stuff that's holding China back.
And if I can just interject, yeah. I mean, I found it really interesting when I read your book that that was the case. I hadn't realized there were that many temples destroyed that early, because, I mean, like, Mao gets a lot of blame for doing this decades later. But in fact, it was already, it didn't come out of nowhere, his impulse to
do
this.
The communists were the most radical of reformers that wanted to change China. And, I mean, the first, most famous revolutionary in China, Sun Yat-sen, who overthrew the last dynasty, one of the first things he did as a young man in Guangdong province in his home village was to go to the local temple with a big stick and smash the statues on the altar, just get rid of all this stuff. So it was all seen as inextricably linked. And I think that opens up the way for foreign religions, especially Christianity, to come in, this feeling that Chinese religion is backward. And the missionaries and the Westerners brought in this paradigm of some religion is okay, other stuff is superstitious. And this terminology didn't exist in China before, it was imported from the West. Of course, Christianity was okay, Islam was okay, although it was pretty much on China's margins. Some bits of Buddhism and Taoism were okay, but most of Chinese religion was just redefined as superstitious and therefore ripe to be destroyed. And that's essentially what happened then. Throughout most of the 20th century.
Okay, so still in the first half of the 20th century, so your family goes through its generations of becoming more educated, remaining Christian, and we get to the generation of your grandfather and your great uncle, who both ended up playing really interesting roles in how Christianity was understood and how it spread in China.
So my grandfather was educated by missionaries from the time he was 12. And the Anglicans sent him to Shanghai to go to St. John's University, which was run by the American Episcopals. And so the Episcopalians then sent him to the United States, to Philadelphia, to go to seminary in the University of Pennsylvania. He returned to Fuzhou in 1921 and really was a rising star. So he was taught at the seminary. He was dean of the Anglican Cathedral. He was just the type of man that the Anglicans needed, because they were well aware of the fact that Protestant Christianity really bore a Western stamp. And they knew that for the church to really take root and continue, they needed to develop Chinese Christian clerics. My grandmother's younger brother was a man known in English as Watchman Nee. And he took a very different approach to Christianity. He was kind of a lax Christian growing up, but when he was a young man, he went to hear a preacher named Dora Yu, and that kind of changed his life. And he became a very fervent Christian from that point on. He would walk around the streets of Fuzhou with his band of brothers, you know, preaching and banging a gong. And he was baptized by immersion in the Min River. But Watchman Nee was very different in that he spurned the denominational churches. He thought that Christianity should return to its roots, and the foreign mission churches with all their hierarchy of priest and bishop, that was not the right way of practicing religion. So he started in the 20s to preach, to go around talking to people, and he was a prolific writer. He wrote a seminal book called The Spiritual Man when he was still in his 20s. So he really had an impact. And the fact that he was Chinese and is very much an indigenous church movement, it really attracted a lot of people who didn't want to align themselves with the foreign missions. You have to remember the 1920s, you know, there was a lot going on in China. There was rising nationalism, and there was a real kind of anti-foreign movement, which sometimes expressed itself as anti-Christian. So in 1927, there was an incident in Fuzhou where there were communist agitators in Fuzhou, and they were just stirring things up, holding protest. And my grandfather, because he was such a prominent Anglican and aligned with the foreigners, there was one day where he was actually attacked and captured by a mob and dragged through the streets for an entire day with a rope around his neck, a dunce cap on his head, and a placard that said "Running Dog of the Foreigners," which is imagery we associate with the Cultural Revolution, but this was 1927. But it was an anti-foreign, anti-Christian moment. And, you know, he was tormented, and they tried to force him to renounce his faith, and he wouldn't do it. So there was that going on, and there is some reason to believe that that political environment really made Watchman Nee even more attractive, because he wasn't foreign, so he became a very prominent and influential religious leader.
Yeah, I mean, 1927 was a really interesting year, because that's also when there was the crackdown by the Kuomintang on the Communist Party, and then the Communist Party ended up going underground and building itself up. What you're describing also sounds like a reaction of the sort we're seeing in many places around the world now to dramatic social change. So people were seeing Western influence come in and change Chinese culture and modernize, and many people welcomed aspects of it while others feared it or felt uncomfortable with it. It's like, well, wait a minute, what is our essence as Chinese people? How can we take what's good about Western ideas but still stay who we are? And where's that line? And it was ever moving. Before we move on to what happened under Mao and the Communist Party, I think the story of your grandmother is very interesting.
So my grandparents were an arranged marriage, and neither of them were very happy about it. My grandfather was summoned home from Philadelphia to enter this marriage to a 19-year-old he didn't know. And my grandmother was also unhappy because she was at the McTeer School, which was run by the Methodist American missionaries. And she had a dream, too. I mean, she wanted to go to the United States to become a doctor, but she had to enter this marriage. And neither of them were particularly happy. But what becomes interesting later in their life, so they're married and they moved from Fuzhou to Shanghai. My grandfather was pastor of a church called St. Peter's, and my grandmother played the organ at the church. She moved then across the street from her brother, Watchman Nee, and Watchman Nee's wife was one of her best friends from Fuzhou. So she starts going to his church with them when they would get together on Sunday to worship. Now, they worshiped in an assembly. It was called a Christian assembly, and they were known as the Little Flock. So it would be just like a house with three houses where they combined them, and that's where they would get together. So the pastor's wife, my grandmother, starts liking this form of worship because it was much different. And she starts going to his church more regularly. And finally, she goes to her husband and she said, I'm not going to join you anymore at the Anglican Episcopal Church. I like my brother's church much more. In the Anglican Church, he spoke from the pulpit. They followed the Book of Common Prayer. And in Watchman Nee's church, it was just, they talked. And I remember asking my aunt, who remembered Watchman Nee, like, what was his appeal? And it was just his ability to explain things in very simple language and the complexity of mankind and how we're following a cosmic clock. So she goes to her husband and she said, I'm not going to go to your church. And he explodes. And the reason I know this is they didn't exactly keep it a secret from the kids. So all the kids remember mom and dad fighting about this. The other thing that's really interesting is what was happening in their marriage was really a microcosm of what was happening in China at large. So I read like the Anglican records from 1937 when they had their synod in China, and they were complaining about men like Watchman Nee and John Tsung and Wang Mingdao, all these independent preachers. And they said they were sheep stealers. They were stealing our Christians who were, you know, more attracted to their assemblies.
This also touches on a bigger theme that you write about at length in your book, Ian, which is there's a yearning over time in China for ritual being the vessel of meaning, for structure, for a way to avoid chaos, luan. But also there was this appeal of this different way of doing things, a, you know, sort of a space that was opened up that allowed a different way of thinking about meaning and thinking about your place in the world. I mean, you've actually written about Watchman Nee and a little bit and about his appeal before Mao came to power. Mm. What do you think that was about? I mean, do you think this was part of modernizing in China?
Yeah, it's interesting because in the early 20th century, there was a famous French, who was actually Catholic, but it could have applied to the Protestants as well. His name was Léon Joly, and he wrote an essay and he said, why did Christianity fail in China? This is early 20th century. There are only about 1 million converts, despite all the schools and hospitals and benefits. They had this idea that China would be like the Roman Empire, where you could convert, you know, in the way people thought of it, you convert the emperor, and then the whole country is going to become Christian. I think the problem that a lot of Christianity faced was that there was a lot of foreigners involved. It was people like Watchman Nee who indigenized Christianity, and especially for Protestantism, this is a big reason for its takeoff in the second half of the 20th century. Because you had people like that who spoke to Chinese people in their own language, not just Chinese, but in imagery, this idea of the cosmic clock and all this stuff. It's real resonances with folk religion. And I think that was a big reason why Christianity actually succeeded. And the other forms are still around in China but are not as dynamic. And these are like the precursors for the house churches today in China, these very people. So it's a fascinating era.
So this was happening before the communists came to power.
20s and 30s and 40s.
And then the communists came to power. And maybe you could both talk a little bit about the ways in which the Communist Party has both persecuted the religious, but also has sort of taken on some of the trappings of being a religious entity, with Mao as kind of a god, and you write about the Great Hall of the People as being kind of the temple, and there are all the rituals.
Yeah, so out of this wreckage of the old system, there are five religions in China, Taoism, Buddhism, Islam, and then they divide Christianity into two religions, right. Protestantism and Catholicism, and those were allowed to exist, but it only lasted for a little while, and then, as you say, Mao took the country increasingly toward radical policies, culminating in the Cultural Revolution, when all religious life was kind of, the public expression of religious life was wiped out. And I think you write about that very movingly in your book about your family, the incredible persecution they faced starting as early as the 1950s.
After 1949.
Even though your grandfather could have been in the official church. He wasn't a watchman, he could never have, but your grandfather could have.
It's really interesting because 1949, December, so after the declaration of the People's Republic of China, there were 19 Christians who made this public declaration to the missionaries. And they basically said, you know, we're going to go through a transition. It's going to be difficult, but we're going to come out okay the other side. Christianity's going to survive, but we're going to have to cut off some withered branches. And my grandfather was one of the 19. He was the only Anglican priest to sign that document. The other men went on to lead the Three Self-Patriotic Movement. The really tragic thing about my grandfather the Three Self-Patriotic Movement is the umbrella organization for kind of official Chinese Christians, the registered churches. So they have to be self-supporting, self-propagating, and self-governing. They wanted no foreign affiliation. So my grandfather signs this document. And so you would think that he would be part of like the group that would help to kind of during this transition. But politics always had a way of interfering with religion. And it wasn't so much about beliefs, but about politics. So what happened with my grandfather is that the Korean War started. And we call it the Korean War, but in China it was the war to resist the United States and aid Korea. And so my grandfather was an Episcopal, so that's very American. He had two sons living in America, and his mentor was Bishop Y.Y. Tsu. And Bishop Y.Y. Tsu was deemed a pariah. And after 1949, it wasn't like they closed churches or anything. Churches could still exist, and there was kind of a movement within the Christian community to kind of preemptively reorganize. And so Zhou Enlai, in 1951, had a meeting. He called all the Christian leaders up to Beijing to talk about how do we create a common cause and move forward. Actually, Watchman Nee was one of the people invited to this meeting. And so they had the meeting, and then to finish the meeting, they had seven denunciations where they singled out seven Christians, four who were foreign and three who were Chinese. And one of the three who was denounced was Bishop Y.Y. Tsu. So for my grandfather, that was like the death knell. He could no longer really function. And in China at the time, it wasn't enough just to say you were patriotic and you wanted to help rebuild the church. You had to prove it. And so for my grandfather, he had to stand up at the pulpit before 1,000 congregants at the Church of Our Savior in the French Concession, and he had to stand there and denounce his mentor as a running dog of the foreigners in the same way that he had been accused of being a running dog of the foreigners back in 1927. During this period, there was a real consolidation, but for my grandfather, he was just on the wrong side of politics, and that was basically the end of his career.
Yeah. And of course, while Christians were persecuted under Mao, all religions pretty much had a very hard time. You spent a lot of time with Taoists and Buddhists and heard stories of what life was like during the Cultural Revolution and basically throughout Mao's entire reign. Something that was really unexpected is you also talked to the descendants of an artisan, Clay Menjong, and even they, this isn't so much religion, but they basically were making these little clay figurines that were very popular in China. And even they were persecuted because this was old culture. I mean, this is how sweeping the crackdown was under Mao and under the Cultural Revolution. What stood out to you most as you were talking to people about what their experience was then in the way that the government was basically rejecting what they held dearest to them in terms of where they got meaning in their lives?
What I think comes through most is that, and I think it's especially true for these traditional religions like Buddhism, Taoism, and the folk religion, was just how much of the physical infrastructure of the old religious life was destroyed. The number of temples, you know, if you think of more concretely than these super round numbers like a million or something, but in Beijing alone in the late 19th century, and there's excellent surveys on Beijing, there were about 800 temples. By the late 1970s, there were just four or five that were left opening. And I can remember going as a student in the early 1980s, using an old guidebook to look around Beijing, trying to find temples, and just so many of them were not there anymore and had been converted into factories or torn down or run by the government. It made it very hard to recover after the Cultural Revolution, I think, for religious life to recover. And I think that's really the biggest legacy of the 20th century, was the, you know, obliteration of... It's really noticeable if you go to places like Taiwan or Hong Kong or even Singapore. If you go to Taipei and you know, there's temples almost on every street and there's little shrines, and that's the way Beijing used to be. Beijing and then other Chinese cities were all like that. There were hundreds of temples. And this one village where I spent a lot of time in Shanxi province, one village had seven temples and now has none. And the township had about two dozen temples up until the 1950s, and now it just has one. So it's just hard to recover from that in some ways.
And behind all this was basically a desire on the part of the Communist Party in general, and Mao Zedong in particular, that there would be one font of meaning in people's lives, and it would be the Communist Party. And some of the propaganda officials did sort of deify Mao. You know, people wore Mao buttons, and if your Mao button hit the floor, this was sacrilege, and you could actually be beaten or worse if that happened. You know, people who survived the Cultural Revolution have these stories to tell where it's like, you know, it almost seems like there was this mass hysteria over the course of several years, and then people kind of were able to wake up from it and step back and think, what just happened to us? Jennifer, you visited your family not long after the Cultural Revolution ended, 1979. The Cultural Revolution ended in 1976. What did you know about what had happened to them before you went, and what did you hear when you got there?
So, you know, I can really pinpoint the moment that my book started, and it was June 18th, 1979. It was my first morning in China. So my father, who had immigrated in 49, took us back to meet the family he left behind. And, you know, the first moments were all sweetness and smiles, and everyone was happy. And then the next morning I woke up, and I'll just never forget seeing my father, because he had this look of shock and fear and sadness on his face. And what happened was, the night before, Watchman Nee's younger brother had pulled him aside and said to him, "Do you have any idea what happened to us?" And the truth of the matter was, we were clueless. I mean, we knew that Watchman Nee had been arrested in 52 and sentenced to prison for 20 years. We suspected that the family had a hard time because they were bad elements. You know, there were capitalists in the family, there were Western-educated people, but we really didn't know how the politics were playing out within the walls of the family. My grandfather would write to us every single month. He stopped abruptly in about 1969, and he sent my father a letter in Chinese saying, "I'm tired, enough of the writing every month, I'm gonna stop." Well, what we didn't know, and what my father only found out, is their lives were hell. I mean, my grandmother, because she was the sister of Watchman Nee, she was accused of being a counter-revolutionary. She was interrogated on a regular basis. Every day she had to kneel before the neighborhood committee to confess her crimes. Her son-in-law was a capitalist. Her sons were in America. Her brother was a counter-revolutionary. So it was just, when we went, my father just learned that from Uncle George. His brother and his sister, their lips were sealed. They refused to talk to him about anything. It was only Watchman Nee's brother who kind of spilled the beans. The family was a little mad. They said, "Don't ruin his reunion." We really didn't know. And when we went home, my father kind of took what he knew, put it in a box, and put it away. And that was that. He couldn't undo the past. But for me, I really just became obsessed with kind of, well, what happened to them? And why? That's what launched this very long journey.
A cousin of yours, Terry, is a very interesting sort of guide to what it was like to be a young person, to be a teenager in the middle of this upheaval, where the sort of the moral center shifted, and she kind of shifted with it. And then afterward was one of the people who woke up and thought, what happened?
So imagine you're 14, and every day you go to school, and you're just attacked. You know, and you're told, if you're the son of a scoundrel, you're a scoundrel. And this was just hammered into her head. So she came to resent my grandmother and Watchman Nee. And, you know, there was one moment where all the cousins, like, stood before my grandmother, who was in bed because she was a very sick woman. And they just said, we will not stand with you. We are not supporting you. We stand against you. We don't believe in Watchman Nee. And they were kind of brainwashed, you know, and my cousin just wanted to curry favor with the Red Guards, and she actually told them, if you want to stay in our ground floor living room, you can just move in. And so the family was furious with her. And she was also kind of keeping track of the family movements. Because she was 14, she felt totally ostracized, and she wanted to gain favor with the radical students. Well, she did wake up and realize that this was just ludicrous. She was one of the many 16-year-olds who went to the countryside to learn from the peasants. So in her case, she went to northeastern China, to this tiny little village, where she became a barefoot doctor. She was delivering babies at age 16 and taking care of people.
And the family kind of forgave her?
Yes. The subtitle of my book is Betrayal and Forgiveness. I mean, people understood what was going on, that, you know, you're a young person, you're ostracized, you're brainwashed, you're going to do things that you might regret.
Is she religious now?
She is not. It's interesting who became religious and who didn't, because of my generation, you know, her sister has become very religious.
Julia.
She's a pianist in Chicago. Terry is more interested, but not really practicing. And a lot of it stems from the fact that religion brought horrible things to the family during the Cultural Revolution. For some of them, they've not been able to recover from that.
So kind of zooming back out, in one of the themes in your book, and I'm quoting here, was showing about how Chinese of different faiths have re-embraced religion since Mao, quote, engaging in a global conversation about how to restore solidarity and values to societies that have made economics the basis of most decisions. That China is engaged in this search the way that many societies are, but perhaps in some ways even more intensely right now. So how much do you think the re-embrace of religion is due to that versus feeling this gap where the Communist Party used to fill, you know, people's sense of meaning, that people have to sort of shift and look for an alternative way to answer the big questions in life and think about, you know, what motivates me, what gives meaning to my life?
A lot of it is driven by this feeling that there are no shared values in Chinese society. People constantly talk in social media, and this is uncensored, it's okay to talk about it, this lack of minimum moral standards in society, that anything goes, as long as you don't get caught, you can get away with anything, or you try to get away with anything. And so there's this feeling that society lacks some kind of center of gravity. And not everybody sees it in religious terms. I mean, some people say the problems in society are
because...
Well, yeah, it's like a cultural level. But I think some people just think that China needs rule of law, they need democracy and things like that, and that will solve the problems in society. But many people see it as a religious or moral problem, that after all the old system was destroyed in the late 19th and early 20th century, communism didn't last, and they need something new. So that's what I tried to find in this book. And I look at five different groups in society, including the government, and I've sort of, these are like micro ethnographic studies of different people over the course of a year, and I go back in time to cover some of the history and so on. But you can see it across the board, Christians, Buddhists, Taoists, etc. Yeah.
You did this lovely weaving in and out of, building around the theme of how the way a society organizes time is kind of central in many ways to what a society is. And so you have the ways in which previous spiritual beliefs, even if people don't actively participate and follow them now, they're just part of the cycles that Chinese live with, the micro cycles of each season. And then there are people who do go to temples and they have temple fairs and they try to continue the traditions that have existed for centuries. Yeah. And you went to many of these fairs.
And also church, because I think Protestant Christianity at least is growing really fast. I mean, some people would argue it's the fastest growing religion in China, so I spent a lot of time with one church in the city of Chengdu to look at that and to sort of weave these stories together through the calendar year and to try to give a overall view of China now. I think what surprises most people is the government's role, that the government is embracing some religions and not others. And maybe not surprisingly, looking at Jennifer's story, one of the religions they have more problems with is Christianity, and they're happier with the so-called traditional religions of Buddhism and Taoism and so on.
So I'm remembering, you know, around the time I started covering China in 1996, one of the first stories I did was looking at this search for meaning. And you might remember Victor Yuan at Horizon Research, which was China's first private survey group. And, you know, he'd do a lot of corporate surveys for money, but then he did other surveys about things that interested him. And one of his surveys in 1996 was, what do you believe in? And he asked people in several different cities around China. And if I'm remembering correctly, the top answers in 96 were myself, money, and nothing. And
the U.S. also.
Organized religion of different types, you know, Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, all had single-digit percentages. Communist Party was around 3%. 10 years later, 2006, he did the same survey in the same cities. And the answers then were fate, luck, myself. For every organized religion, the percentages had more or less doubled. Communist Party was still 3%. The number of Christians in China now is somewhere between 60 and 100 million, about 10 million Catholics. And Watchman Nee remains kind of a beloved figure among many Christians in China.
In 2015, I went back to Fuzhou to kind of write the last chapter, but also to gauge kind of the legacy of Watchman Nee and my grandfather. And Ian, you were reporting out of Wenzhou at the time about the crackdown in this city of Wenzhou, where the local authorities were tearing down crosses from churches, and there were like 1,500. So I showed up in Fuzhou, which is only 150 miles south of Wenzhou, feeling a little apprehensive and anxious, like, what would I find there? What would the mood be? And I went to the cathedral where my grandfather used to work, and that was a registered church with the Three Self Patriotic Movement, and that was open and thriving, and they were tearing down the entire neighborhood around it, but the church was being saved. I then went to house churches, and in these house churches, the people still read Watchman Nee's writings. They sang his hymns. There was a real openness, and, you know, I met one gentleman who was 98 years old who had spent 24 of the last 60 years in prison because he was, you know, a co-worker of Watchman Nee. And so he was very open, though, with me and met me, and he said 10 years ago, just meeting me could have gotten him in trouble. But in Fuzhou, in Fujian province at least, they had worked very hard, the house churches, to develop good relations with the local authorities, which I found kind of surprising. I mean, given that just to the north there was this tension going on, but they felt that they couldn't say what was going to happen in the rest of China, but as far as Fujian province, which is a little different anyway, you know, that they felt that there was a good relationship with the government. It was not the picture I expected when I got there.
Yeah, good reminder that China is not a monolith and the government's not a monolith. But while we're still on Watchman Nee, some of his followers, or people who had followed his followers indirectly, ended up starting this curious sect called Eastern Lightning, which you write about.
Yeah, Protestantism has a lot of sects, especially in the 80s and 90s. There was a lot more of this charismatic, cultish behavior. I think because people had been persecuted for so long that there was sort of this underground bunker mentality that a lot of groups had. And this group still exists in China and has been a target of the government. So yeah, they rose to infamy a couple of years ago when one of their members, a family, beat a woman to death in a McDonald's with a mop handle because they thought she looked at them funny or something like that.
And they thought she was possessed or something?
Something like that, because she wouldn't join the group. I think they went over to try to convert her and they didn't or something like that. So, I mean, you know, there are still a lot of groups that have been warped or something by, I tend to think it's because of government pressure, that there is this underground mentality for some groups. But, I mean, overall, I'd say the overall feeling is sort of what you found in Fujian, that churches, even so-called underground churches, are much more open nowadays, and that they work with the government, or at least they let the government know what they're doing. And even the term underground church is almost not accurate anymore, because the government knows that they're there. They're not really underground in secret anymore. And so it's kind of interesting. The government knows this is going on, and as long as they're not agitating against the government, as long as they're not too political, they can get away with a lot.
So how does Xi Jinping fit into all this?
I think he sees an opportunity or a problem. The problem is that there is this feeling in society of moral malaise, a lack of values, and especially since he started before he took power in 2012, but especially since then, the government's ramped up this project to embrace traditional values. You can think of it a little bit like Vladimir Putin in Russia supporting the Orthodox Church. You have this strange image of a former KGB officer and Putin, you know, going to the Orthodox churches. And so Xi Jinping doesn't go to temples and worship, but they've supported a lot of traditional religious practice, rebuilding temples, even subsidizing temple fairs. And I think this is because they see this as an opportunity. Again, as long as it's not political. The moment it steps over into political or through foreign ties, just like in, you know, 1927, you will be attacked by the government and they'll come down hard on you. But otherwise, the government thinks it can work with religion. And that's, of course, a big gamble, because governments have, throughout history, have thought, oh, I can work with religion, I can make use of it, and then there's often a blowback. But we don't know what will happen. But
yeah.
Who knows? Yeah.
And then there's also, in addition to that, the government's still using rhetoric that kind of puts a religious tinge on the nationalistic project. Like during the Olympics, they talked about the Olympic torch's journey as the sacred journey, the sacred mission. And there are a lot of these images that come up where if you're not embedded in the society and hearing that kind of rhetoric all the time and taking it for granted, you're kind of like, say what? So you were in China, living in China in the 90s for several years, and then, you know, you've been coming back in regularly when you know, working on your book, and then just out of interest and on reporting trips. What kind of shift have you seen beyond just looking at the Christian communities that you focused on that are, were connected to your family and beyond? What kind of shift have you seen in the way that people look at where their center of meaning is?
That's a really hard question. Oh, boy.
So mid-90s, economic growth was just starting. It wasn't quite taking off yet, but it was kind of like sitting on the runway where you can hear the engine start to rev up. I mean, I remember some people I talked to then talking with some nostalgia about how, you know, back when Mao was in power, everyone was equal and people treated each other more decently. I was like, but there were all these other things that happened where people were beaten to death. And it felt like there was like this gap then and a yearning for it to be filled. And some people reached for Christianity. Some people started visiting Taoist temples again. Confucianism started being taught in weekend classes to bureaucrats and to businessmen, and more sort of upper middle class Chinese and the creative classes started embracing Tibetan Buddhism. It became sort of faddish to embrace Tibetan Buddhism. That was one phase, and it almost feels like now there's another phase where there's a younger generation coming up that didn't grow up in a religious environment necessarily. And they're making some of their own decisions about what matters and where they look for ways of, you know, reflecting on their values and people who inspire them.
The reason I paused for so long is I echo what you're saying, because when I lived there from 96 to 99, that's what I saw. Since then, I've been going in and out of China on these short trips, so it's very hard for me to really get a sense of that deeper quest for meaning among people. But I do find that, you know, like when I was just there briefly in the last time in 2015, that, you know, among the house churches that I was going to, there were a lot of younger people there. It wasn't just old people who were renewing kind of a habit of going to the churches. There were like young teenagers, there were kids, you know, and so maybe there is just more of an interest and an openness to it.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the key points that I found is that this need for community. I think this is something we find in our own societies as well. There's this feeling that people don't care for each other, that there aren't shared experiences. And especially though, you got to think in China, you know, when we were there in the 90s, it was, I don't know, still something like two-thirds rural or something like that. And now, living in cities like Beijing, like I do, Beijing now has 20-odd million people, and it's majority urban, at least on paper. So people have been thrust into these big, alienating cities with no network, no community, and for many of them, religious groups are an instant community. And so you find this especially with the churches, that they're very good at that, at recruiting young people who have moved to big cities, white-collar professionals, and a lot of these churches are now very well-educated people, and some of the people that the government really, I think, is counting on sort of for the future, and yet they're attracted to Protestantism, but also other religions are trying to catch up too. Buddhism has also adapted some of these structures to be a little bit more like the churches and proactively recruiting people, proselytizing even. So there's big sort of competition among the religions as well.
You know, I was talking recently to Joseph Lee. He's a scholar at Pace University who studies Christianity in China. And one of the trends that he was discussing, too, is that, you know, there's been such a migration to the cities. And in the cities, there's been a flourishing of house churches and attendance at even registered churches. And he said what's happening now is a lot of those people who may have gone to Shenzhen or Guangzhou for work are now going home and into pockets of China where there may not have been a missionary tradition or a Christian tradition, and they're proselytizing. So they're actually kind of doing this reverse migration back home and spreading Christianity that way into the reaches of China.
Seeding churches, which you write about.
Yeah, the influence of overseas, especially American Protestantism, evangelism is huge in China. These books get translated anyway for Christian communities in Taiwan and Hong Kong or Chinese American communities, and then are available as a PDF download online. And these ideas like church planting, where you hive off a bit of a congregation and plant it in another part of the city and grow it there, these are all really popular, really in topics. But also, I was really struck in how groups like Buddhists are doing similar things. A lot of temples in China are on the outskirts of cities, so it's hard to get to, but they imitate the host churches in that they have, instead of having a Bible study group, say on Wednesday evening at somebody's home, they have a sutra study group at somebody's home, and just like a dozen people meeting in the living room, and then they read some of the sutras, the Diamond Sutra or something, and that way you get people in their communities, and then on the weekends, if they have time, they can go to the temple out in the mountains or something like that. But it's a real period of innovation that harkens back to the 1920s and 30s when there was a lot of this going on too.
So speaking of innovation, I just have a couple more questions, and I'll open it up to questions from you. So think about what you might want to ask, and we'll have a mic going around. So innovation is something I've been interested in, and the Chinese government's quest over the past 20 years to try to increase the level of innovation in China to make China a global power in innovation. The government has long seen this as a point of national pride, but also as a point of economic necessity. China's had its era of low-wage laborers in factories and export-driven growth, and now it needs something new, a new engine to drive its economic growth. At the same time, the government has been encouraging people to embrace a kind of approach to Confucian beliefs, the sort of legalist form of Confucianism, which stresses hierarchy and know your place in society and respect those who are senior to you in power. You know, there is order and there are standards, and don't question them. And so there's this tension on different levels between the different things that are desired in society by the government, for sure, but possibly also by individuals. I mean, you have a younger generation that is quite open and connected with the world, and you also write about how increasingly, as China has opened up, there's been this interesting full circle effect where, you know, under Watchman Nee and at a particular time in China, Chinese wanted indigenous religion. They wanted their own approach to religion, and now they kind of want to synthesize international standards. There are these different things pulling in different directions, different ways that China wants to sort of discover what its essence is.
Maybe in the government, a lot of people think that religion is something, a tool that can be used or won't cause any problems if we keep an eye on it. But all religions create this idea of a higher form, higher values that are beyond any one government. And the Christians I talked to in China always liked to say that, oh, this is unique to Christianity. Only Christianity gives these idea of God-given rights, and God-given rights are fundamental to democracy, and so on and so forth. But I think all religions, and talking to the folk practitioners and this pilgrimage that I describe, or the Buddhists, they all have ideas, and one overarching idea is of justice and righteousness, right, and this idea of heaven, tian, which is above everything else, and that this is a fundamental idea that I think, I don't say it's a problem for the government, it's not like going to lead to a overthrow of the party in 5 years or something, but it helps create among people this idea that it's not the government that gives us justice, it's not the government that gives us rights and laws, it comes from heaven, it's something higher. And I think that's the change that religion could bring to China in the future.
And do you think the government feels threatened by that at this point?
I think they feel like they can work with it. Governments in China for many, many centuries have tried to guide religion, and I think that they feel pretty confident. I mean, the government under Xi Jinping and in general, you have a very self-confident government running China, and I think they feel they can do it. But yeah, who knows how it'll work out in the long run.
Yeah. So my last question is, you both spent a lot of time thinking about religion over the last few years. And Ian, you've actually become you've gone through the practice of meditation and Taoist walking and, you know, all sorts of other things. And I'm wondering if your own sense of the center of meaning has shifted as a result.
Not really, in my case. I mean, it hasn't really changed my sense of meaning. I mean, I'm a Catholic, and for me, it's more personal in terms of my personal relationship with relatives. And what I came away from this process with is just kind of in awe of the religious beliefs of people in the face of great persecution. And to actually witness it by exploring it, you know, in terms of the past, and like my grandfather, my grandmother, to me, that is just, it brings me awe, you know, to think that someone could withstand persecution to the degree they did because of their beliefs. I mean, it didn't change my beliefs, but it did kind of change my appreciation and my respect for those who are faithful.
Yeah.
I was also struck by just how this debate or this discussion or whatever in China is so similar to other countries. I think so many countries around the world have made economics the basis of society, and you know, the bottom line rules everything. I think maybe China's ahead of the curve because they have had such a no-holds-barred form of capitalism over the past 30 or 40 years that they're struggling with these as much as the UK with Brexit or the United States with Trump and all these things, that the people are just feel uncertain and unsure about society. And China's part of this global conversation that people are having. And I think I think it's a hopeful sign, actually. And I think there's a lot of, in talking to people, you rarely had a feeling, even though I'm obviously a foreigner in China, but people were often engaging me and asking me what I thought, and didn't we also have similar problems, and so on and so forth.
There was that drunk guy who kept asking, why are we here?
Right. A lot of drunk people in my book, yeah. It was a fair amount of, somehow, and a book on religion ends up with a lot of cigarette smoking and liquor drinking. But anyways, I think it was heartening. The drinking, at least.
Okay, questions.
Just following up on this economic notion and the idea of capitalism, as an observer, much more casual observer than the three of you of China over my adult life, moving out of the Cultural Revolution, it seems like capitalism became the religion. And I'm wondering, do the existing emerging new faiths or old faiths, do they have a conflict with this notion of no holes barred capitalism, which seems to be the de rigueur way that the government has gone about managing the country's growth?
I think, yeah, to a degree, for sure. Some of the religions and spiritual groups, because I think religion, you can define it sort of broadly, not just to be sort of organized religions, but they talk about this. There was a Confucian master profile in the book who often challenged people to think more morally when making decisions rather than just what's going to make the most money. He was a dinner, somebody came up to him and said, I've got this great surefire way to make money. I've got a cure for Alzheimer's. And so this Confucian master, who's 94 years old, says, this is just going to cheat people. He says, old people get old and then they die. You can't change that. And then the guy's like, well, what about green technology? And he says, that's future-oriented. You should support that. And so, you know, I mean, this kind of things, it's, I think some of the religions do force challenge this idea.
Hi, thank you for a great presentation. Do I understand that there's a certain amount of proselytizing that's is going on now, basically sort of seeping in through the internet and so on? And do I also understand that there are no active foreign missionaries in China now?
Well, when I was there in 99, the foreign missionaries were not allowed to be working officially in China, but they would work in China as teachers or other jobs like that. So, for instance, the Catholic service that I went to, the priest was actually teaching at a university somewhere in Beijing. So I think there are missionary-type individuals who work in China, but in different capacities. But my information's a little dated. I'm not sure if
I think that's right. I think there are some people who go on, you know, to teach English, but they're actually having Bible study. I don't think Chinese really need that so much anymore. There are enough people in China, there's enough money smuggling Bibles into China. All that's sort of 20 years, you know, out of date, and we're thinking about China pretty much self-generating. There's a little bit of know-how that can come in through the internet and be helpful, but I don't think too much.
And as you wrote about, I mean, there's also a recognition in underground churches or churches that if we start taking foreign money or if we have foreign connections, it's going to cause us problems that we don't need to have.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could have the public security guy sitting in the back of our service, as you described in your book, and as long as you skirt the edges of actually saying something openly critical of the party, they don't shut down the service necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Question here.
Yeah, thank you very much. This has been great. I know more about religions in Vietnam right now than I do about them in China. And I know, for example, that the non-Viet population of Vietnam, which is about 15% perhaps, it's hard to say, is very different in terms of what religions they follow. Most of them are either animists or Protestants. And they're the only group in Vietnam that has a very significant Protestant presence. I wondered about we don't know exactly how many non-Han Chinese there are in China, but it would appear that there are at least 150 million, which is close to half the population of the United States.
Yeah.
So I wondered what kinds of spiritual traditions were at work and active within the non-Han Chinese communities. Not Tibet, that's something we all know more about, but the many other communities, including all those that are along the borders of Southeast Asia.
So Han Chinese make up 91 to 92% of the 1.4 billion. So, yeah, it's like 100 million or something. Of those, maybe 20-odd million are Muslim. Most of them are not in Xinjiang, that area that we always read about in the news with the terrorism and so on. Most are scattered around China in another ethnic group called the Hui. And then there's a whole bunch of... There's 55 other ethnic groups among those sort of 100 plus million people. Some animists, some Chinese style religion, Christianity as well. But my book, I handle Han Chinese because I felt like I had 1.3 of the 1.4 billion was enough. And I go, you go into the others and you get 55 little groups and they all have their own history and it would get too complicated. So
yeah, but one thing that could be said about some of those little groups, like the Miao, which are like the Hmong in Laos and the Dong, the government, starting a decade or more ago, started discouraging them from learning in their language or continuing their cultural traditions in their villages. They encouraged them to move to the cities, and once they did, they didn't really have time for,
you know.
Jennifer, I'm curious, in writing your book, if you faced decisions about certain things that if you published would have been difficult for family members in China and you had to censor information, and also whether or not, as you sorted through betrayals, Were there certain relatives that you just didn't end up liking much? And, you know, when you write a book, your heroes you should love. But was there some difficulty in that area at all?
In terms of the first question, I was really concerned, but mostly in terms of just writing about the present, like what the, you know, what the situation was today with the followers of Watchman Nee. Because Watchman Nee is still a counter-revolutionary, technically. So I was very concerned. I ended up sharing a draft with someone who I trusted who would be able to tell me if what I was saying was okay. What I didn't want to do is get anyone in trouble, really. So there's that. In terms of, like, not liking anyone, it wasn't so much that someone came across as a villain, but I found that my grandfather was a very complex person. And he had strengths and he had weaknesses. And he was very prideful. And, you know, he probably irked some people. Like, I found this one letter in the archives of the Anglican Church where my grandfather had decided to leave Fuzhou and go elsewhere. And the bishop is writing to the Home Office saying, yeah, he's been in some tight corners, but he's also, like, really ticked off a lot of people, so it's best that he move on. So I think what I found, you know, in this whole process is that my grandfather and my grandmother were very complex people, but no true villains.
I was based in Beijing from 87 to 89, and I had an assignment to cover the midnight mass at the Northern Cathedral. Mm. And I got there along with my assistant, and we had to fight our way through the crowd because it was completely jammed. And it was mostly young couples going to church, but the real congregants were in the front, who were mostly old ladies. And I asked my assistant, what's going on here? This is ridiculous. Religion is supposedly outlawed here, you know. And she said, oh, well, it's like a date, you know, it's like going to a show to see this thing. So I'm just kind of curious what the timeline is. And also during this same period, I traveled with Billy Graham and his wife back to Jiangsu, where she was born. And he did preach one time, as I recall, during that. But I'm just wondering what the timeline, the timeline was from that point where religion was sort of had become a curiosity to where it's something that a significant number of people are genuinely embracing.
I think we really began to see it in the 90s. When I was working there, which was from 96 to 99, there was real interest, and you could sense the momentum. But I think there was and Ian, you can speak more about this, but there was a real chilling effect in 1999 when we covered the Falun Gong protest in Tiananmen Square in May of 1999. And after that, there was, you know, a crackdown not only on Falun Gong, but on all cults. And one of the cults that was identified by the government were the Shouters. And the Shouters have tight ties to Watchman Nee and also to one of his followers, Witness Lee. And that really created a chilling effect, at least in the house church movement that's aligned with Watchman Nee. Over time, in Fujian province, you know, it was because of that 99 decision that they were cultish that the Watchman Nee house churches really tried to normalize relations with the authorities, and that's why they started this dialogue. In at least Fujian, where I was looking at, there's been a real continued resurgence in interest in Christianity. But again, I mean, I think in the 90s, we really started seeing it. Would you agree about the Falun Gong, though?
I think it had a chilling effect, yeah. A lot of those groups got closed down, but a lot of them have come back in other forms. And one of the groups I describe in my book is a meditation group, and they're basically a kind of qigong group. It's like that, but they are differently organized. But yeah, I think it's just built up over the reform era. As paradoxically, as China got wealthier and as the economy sort of took off, it just created this feeling. Somebody said to me, we thought we were unhappy because we were poor. Now a lot of us aren't poor, but we're still unhappy. So, yeah.
Does everyone here know what Falun Gong is? Does anyone not know? Okay, so you got the Pulitzer Prize for it. You go ahead.
Okay, so there's this movement in the 80s and 90s called Qigong, which is a kind of physical cultivation practice like yoga. You can think of it like an analogous to yoga in the Indian tradition, but more meditation and stuff. And this Falun Gong was the most militant of these groups. There were many of them, and throughout the 90s, they began to write, the people who ran them wrote books and so on and so forth, and they got into a conflict with the government in 1999. The government banned them. And
oh, but describe that day in late April.
Oh, so they had, they were worried that they were going to be closed down. They thought, if only we could let, this is what people always think, if only the central government knew the local officials are bad, but the emperor in this forbidden city is good. So if only the central government knew how good we are, it would all, they would lift the ban, they wouldn't ban us. And so they went there, thousands and thousands of people, and did this sit down meditation.
Older people with thermoses.
Yeah, just camping out in front of the government headquarters. So when they opened their doors in the morning, it was like, holy crikey, you know, like, what happened? And this must be the most terrifying group of all time.
Absolutely quiet. They wouldn't talk to anyone. They wouldn't be interviewed by journalists.
Yeah. What was our Public Security Bureau doing? They were supposed to have a secret police, but they...
Huh? This was in Beijing.
It was in Beijing.
Right outside the leadership compound.
And then they had a nationwide crackdown, closed, shut down the organization, arrested people, and so on, threw people in jail.
Thank you for the wonderful conversations. And one question for Ian Johnson. What do you think about the state promotion of Confucianism as almost like a state religion and the kind of popularity of Confucius Institute around the world? And another question for Jennifer Lin is, since you're talking so much about your family originally from Fujian, Fuzhou, why the titles Shanghai Faithful? Were there, just because they're educated in Shanghai? And why not Fuzhou Faithful?
So in Confucianism, I think the government is supporting some forms of Confucianism, especially the idea of hierarchy and hierarchically organized society is something that they like. They think it will also filial piety, supporting your parents in an aging population. Yeah, with an aging population, that you are now legally responsible to look after your parents, to visit them. But what the government doesn't want is Confucianism also gives you the right to protest, the right to rebel. And Confucianism is not this black and white cartoon character thing that just supports authority. It is also, for centuries and centuries in China, officials protested against government policies by appealing to the ideals of Confucianism. And China's, you know, first dissident, you could say, Chu Yuan in the 3rd century, committed suicide because he felt his ruler was not following the proper ways of ruling. So I think that it's again, a double-edged sword. That they want a little bit of it, the thing that will support their view of how society should be run, but they don't want all the other ideals that come with religion.
So I entitled it Shanghai Faithful for marketing reasons. Shanghai is evocative, and if I had named it Fujian Faithful, I mean...
It has more consonants. Sounds better.
They did live in Shanghai, okay? And I did make my first visit to Shanghai. So, and plus, my personal editor, my husband, thought Shanghai Faithful sounded better. So...
But they were
That's
living
the
in...
That's the honest answer.
But they were living in Shanghai.
They were living in Shanghai. Yeah, so. Come on, give me a break.
Thank you both for your presentation. I had a question for Ian. So I've been hearing more and more about the party's crackdown on Protestant churches, I guess especially in Wenzhou. But what I've been noticing is that these churches are not only the underground house churches, but also registered state churches. So I wanted to know if you had any intuition about what it was about these churches that were getting their crosses taken down or people arrested, or was this a more of a Wenzhou-specific occurrence, or was it a Protestant-specific occurrence? I just wanted to hear more about that.
Yeah, so between 2014 and 2016, there was this campaign against churches in this province just next to where your family was from, and you alluded to that in your comments that you were worry because you were there in 2015. So about 1,500 churches had the crosses cut off the top of them, including, as you said, some state-run churches. I think the main problem is a couple of, I think the overall problem was they didn't like how present Christianity was in the cityscapes. So if you landed in Wenzhou Airport, this is a big city on the coast of China, you land at the airport and you take the elevated highway into town and you looked out over the city, you saw all these crosses and you think, my goodness, I must be in a majority Christian city. You know, there must be like, you know, an Italian city 100 years ago or something. So, but actually, even in Wenzhou, only, say, 15% of the people are Christian, but they were just really present. And I think the government just didn't want that to define the way this province looked. There are some personal political reasons as well, but I think that's the overall point. And I think the key thing to remember, though, is of those 1,500 churches, only one was demolished. The others were left and still have congregations, and the campaign's over. Now, whether that will continue in the future, the government has new regulations on religion that were promulgated last year. They could target Christianity. It could become harder, but so far, no. And I think it was just a specific event.
If you don't mind, I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about the arranged marriage with your grandparents. How did that relationship develop and maintain itself over time?
The arranged marriage story is really interesting because my grandfather was part of that generation of Chinese who really wanted to come to the United States, learn as much as they could, and then go back to make China strong, right? And so my grandfather left in 1918, and he had every intention of spending at least 10 years in Philadelphia. He was going to get his doctorate in sacred studies from the seminary, and he was going to get a PhD in philosophy from Penn. 2 years into his studies, he gets the telegram from home from his father saying, "Your younger brother wants to get married, but before he can get married, you have to be married. I found someone for you to marry. Come home." And so for my grandfather, you know, he represented this generation that was very progressive, you know, that was fired up by the May 4th movement of 1919. And so for him, it was this real quandary of, was he a progressive modern man who would say no to his father and just pursue his academic goal? Or would he be the Confucian obedient son and return home? So he returned home, of course, and got married. So the two of them entered into this marriage just miserable. They assumed their expected roles as husband, wife, father, mother. And then what's really interesting, though, and I know this from, like, interviewing my cousins and talking to the people around them, is he really grew to respect her in a way, you know, because, you know, she really withstood the brunt of the persecution during the Cultural Revolution. And when she died, because she was a counter-revolutionary, she wasn't allowed to have a proper funeral. So instead of, as you describe in your book, all the pageantry around funerals, she couldn't have a wreath around her. She was put on a gurney in a hallway, you know, at the funeral home, and the family just had to say goodbye. But there was just this poignant moment where a cousin of mine recounted for me that at that moment, the family is like shamed because she was a counter-revolutionary. She actually had a tag around her that said counter-revolutionary. And my cousin Julia remembers my grandfather going up to her and patting her on the head and saying, "Bessie, my Bessie." And he used her English nickname, which none of the Chinese workers around would know what he was saying at all. But, you know, so there was this, their marriage evolved into a loving one according to everyone around them. And there was, you know, the proud Anglican had then a deep respect for my grandmother.
And so it is in life. Relationships evolve. Beliefs evolve. A nation's sense of itself and its place in the world evolves. And that shapes eras. It shapes centuries, often in ways not easily predicted. Boy, have we seen that play out of late. Thanks to Ian and Jennifer for sitting down with me to have this conversation, and to the Mechanics Institute for co-sponsoring it. The books, again, are called The Souls of China, that's by Ian Johnson, and Jennifer Lin's book is Shanghai Faithful. Great reads, well-written, often personal and poignant. I recommend them. The print version of this story and photos and links related to it are at pri.org/century, along with all of our podcasts to date. This is number 44. You can also hear us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't already subscribed, please do. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. It helps others find it. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's sponsored by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.